Good evening, everyone. My name is Jorge. I'm an alcoholic. I'm really grateful to be here tonight. Kat, can you please give me like a 2-minute warning?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so yeah, I want to first of all welcome Gail, Nikki, Niall, Tori, Michelle, and John. I'm really grateful that all of you are here. You're in the right place. And welcome to any visitors, and happy birthday to any celebrants. So, yeah, my name is Jorge. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, which is something I don't know that I've ever thought I would say and be proud to say. But it's something I've come to accept, and I'm happy working a program of recovery. My sober date is June 10th of 2018, so I've got 2 years and 8 months, and this is the first time in my life that I've ever had recovery. I've had bouts of times of sobriety, but I've never worked a program, and so that's important for me to differentiate, because when I was sober and not drinking, I was pretty much still creating the wreckage. And I was still that tornado destroying things and then looking around and being like, but hey, I'm not drunk, right? It's okay. Whereas now I can actively work a program, be in conscious contact with a higher power, and begin to spiritually heal. And that's really important to me, is to heal spiritually from this, from the malady that is really the deepest cause for my drinking. I've really come to believe and accept that the bottle was just a symptom, and working the program and the steps have really allowed me to see that, certainly in my inventory, in my character defects, and in my amends. And I also recognize intergenerational trauma. My father was an alcoholic, my grandfather was an alcoholic, and if I choose then to believe in the spiritual malady, I can look back and think that, or believe that they too had a spiritual malady which caused them to drink. And by working a program of recovery, not only am I healing, but I also feel, excuse me, that they are healing as well. And so I'm not only doing this for myself, but I'm actually healing like generations before me and generations to come. And it's by the grace of God. I don't take any credit for that. It's just, it's pretty miraculous to start thinking that, because I'm really selfish. I'm a selfish alcoholic. And to have that realization that maybe this is something greater than me, maybe I'm a part of a chain that's bigger than me, is really monumental and truly a gift. So, you know, I come from a long line of alcoholics. I don't remember the first time I took a drink. I was born into an alcoholic household that also had codependence heavily. So I have both, very codependent and also an alcoholic. But I did have a spiritual experience when I was about 7 or 8. It was a dream I had that was really powerful. And so I can recognize that, and I believe this, that just as long as I have had my alcoholism, which is all my life, I have also had a spiritual connection to a higher power, even if I didn't realize it. And that's really powerful for me to recognize. The drunkalogue, I can share that, but it's we all have our drunkalogue. What's the solution? I've been in crazy situations. I've been in the insane, the irritable, restless discontent. I can recognize that now. But certainly for me, if I am happy, joyous, and free, it's because I'm working a program. And I honestly believe that it's only by working a program I can achieve that. But I can also look back, and I wouldn't be able to appreciate where I'm at unless I had gone so far down the scale as I had. I do not at all believe that I can appreciate the dawn unless I've lived in the darkness. And that's just my belief, but I think that's one of the beautiful things about recovery, is that I do not regret the past, nor do I wish to shut the door on it. And like the 9-step promises say, no matter how far down the scale I have gone, I can see how my experience, Jorge M, can benefit other people's, and everybody here, like our experience can benefit others. And that's a really powerful tool. It's a really powerful realization to have that my story is my experience, strength, and hope. And I've gotten that by sharing and by helping others. My story includes one of my parents committing suicide, geographics, just insanity, and the tools that I use to deal with that kind of those kinds of situations and that trauma, which was really to drink. That was my tool. Those were my tools to drink and to use. I am a big pothead, or I was, as well as an alcoholic. And I don't look back and think, oh, you know, that was wrong of me to do that. I recognize that that's all the tools that I had at the time. And so now I have other tools. I have people I can contact. I have the steps that I can work. But certainly admitting powerlessness and unmanageability was one of the most powerful things that I could have ever done in my life. And it takes strength that I don't even know like where it came from. And it's like, it's beyond human understanding for me. And it's just by the grace of God that I was given the chance to really deep within my heart, admit that kind of powerlessness and accept who I am. It's really mind blowing for me to even think about that. But like it says, I mean, the delusion that someday I'm going to be like other people has to be smashed. And I think that's really powerful language to use, but it's something that really needs to be said. And I think that for me personally, I had to hear I had to hear a kind of message that had depth and weight to it to really understand, like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to be like other people. I'm not like other people, and that's okay. And at times I'm not okay, and that's okay. We're okay. I'm okay. It's going to be okay. Even if maybe at the moment I'm not okay. And maybe the shaking and the shivering on a physical level have stopped because I've stopped drinking, but maybe sometimes in my spirit, it still is happening. It's going to be okay. And I have that faith that, you know, if I need to take it 24 hours at a time, one day at a time, I can. But maybe sometimes I just need to take it one deep breath at a time, and that's going to be okay. And that's what this program has given me, and that's what recovery has given me. And I have a loving higher power. I have a connection to a higher power that, like I mentioned, I believe I always had. It's just I also strayed away from that higher power. And I'm in connection now with that higher power more than ever, more than I've ever been before. And that's not only comforting, but like I was saying, it's something so much more than me. I'm not only doing this. Thank you. 2 minutes. I'm not only doing this for me. It's like I recognize like the healing aspect of generations from the past and generations to come. And it's not a burden. It's in no way a burden to me. It's uplifting. To be vulnerable with somebody else, to be vulnerable with my sponsor, to be vulnerable with sponsees, to witness the growth of another individual in the program and to see them sponsor people now, to know that I could be of service. Instead of being that tornado in the lives of other people, I can actually help others and be of service. Is one of the best gifts that I could have been given. And so for that reason, I really think that as alcoholics or addicts in recovery, we truly are blessed people. We truly are, because we can use our experience to help others. And I don't have to live in darkness anymore or isolation. And although at times I may be alone, right now in the pandemic, we're literally, I'm in a room alone. I'm not alone at the same time. Like I still have the spirit of the fellowship, and I still can speak the language of the heart and hear the language of the heart, which I don't hear with my ears, right? I feel it with my heart. I feel it with my spirit. And that's just, it's a gift. What can I say? So with that, I think that I'm so grateful to have been asked to share. And I'm really grateful that there's 44 of us in here right now. So welcome once again to the newcomers. Keep coming back. You are in the right place. And I really am glad you're here. And thank you for letting me be of service.
Hi, I'm Maitreya. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here. I'm always pleased to be asked to speak in an AA meeting. There is no place I would rather be on a Saturday night than in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And God, Jorge, that was such a wonderful, powerful share. I feel very related to you. I don't know you. But that was, it was just great in so many ways. And I relate, very much relate to the intergenerational trauma. All sorts of things that you said that were just wonderful. And I'm so glad you're here. And welcome Gail, Nikki, Niall, Tori, John, and Michelle, and anybody else who's new or returning. I owe Alcoholics Anonymous my life. Oh, I was going to put on a headset, and I didn't. So I think I will, just in case. It's probably a little
better sound. So my sobriety date, some stats. I'm a little bit nervous. I've never actually spoken for 40 minutes before. I think I've been a 30-minute speaker a couple of times, but it's not quite 40, so that's good. I got sober January 23rd, 1997. So this January, I celebrated 24 years, which is stunning and shocking and hilarious. And I don't, I know it seems ridiculous that people keep on saying it's one day at a time, but the fact is it's one day at a time. I stay sober today. I don't stay sober for a year. I stay sober for a day. And, but what I do think is really wonderful about the experience of staying sober over a long time is that I now have this history. I have this sober history of walking through things without having to pick up a drink or drugs. And, it has built my belief that it is possible to get through things sober, where when I came in here, I had to take it on faith from people around me because I had not gotten through anything sober. And now I can take it from my own experience, which is just a really very comforting thing to know that, yeah, things can be really hard. I can go through really difficult challenges. I can be heartbroken. I can be afraid, but I don't have to drink. And that I have learned in AA, and I'm very, very grateful for that. So in a general way, what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, my mom was a drug addict. I related, again, Jorge, it was wild. Just ding, 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 ding. So my parents were hippies, and they named me after the Buddha yet to come. Maitreya is how the Buddhists pronounce it, but they pronounced it Maitreya. And, basically from the first breath with the crying, I let my mother down because she really expected me to come and basically be like the next Buddha and make everything good. And instead I was a baby, and I did not do that. And she already was pretty heavily into drugs and alcohol by the time I got here. But in my infancy, she got into heroin, and she was into that for a long time. And then she's into a bunch of, basically she never drew a sober breath. She still managed to live to age 63. And died with a crack pipe in her hand, homeless. And so I lived with her and my older half sister as a child. My parents broke up when I was a toddler. And I would visit my dad from time to time, like weekends and longer vacations. He lived in a different part of California than I did for a few years. And then he went back to New York where he was from. And so I would visit him for Christmas and summer vacations. And he was not an addict. And he was always trying to get me to move away from my mother. But it was the 70s, and I was not prepared to leave her or my older sister, who wasn't his kid. And so even though there was this other way, I could have gone and lived somewhere safe. And I kept on choosing to be with my mom, who was intermittently homeless, probably had undiagnosed mental illness, and was just on drugs all the time. And it was a really shitty childhood to have. It taught me a few things, that some survival skills that were actually very useful until they stopped being useful. And among them was to do school. I was lucky enough to be good at school, and I learned how to ingratiate myself to teachers, and they were like substitute mommies for me. And I did that. I worked the teacher angle for several years. And what it enabled me to do was get very good at school, learn to do school. And that has turned out to be of huge benefit to me in my life. I've ended up getting a lot of education. I've ended up having a career because of it. And now I teach, so it's just even better. But when I was little, our mom used to give us drugs to calm us down, to make us quiet, to get us out of the way. You know, there's a photo of me. It was in a proof sheet that my uncle was a photographer, and he had all these proof sheets. And when he died, we got all of his stuff. And there was a photo of me in a diaper and a Snoopy t-shirt. So a toddler reaching up to be handed a roach. And, that was like kind of how it was. And I remember getting other kids high when I was 9. They would come over after school. So, you know, there never was the thing that you sometimes hear in AA about, like, feeling like I didn't belong or feeling uncomfortable in my own skin until I found alcohol or something else, because I never got a chance to have any of those feelings because I was drugged from a fairly young age. I did at every opportunity to drink. There wasn't a lot of alcohol around when I was a kid. She was a drug addict, not really into booze yet. And but when there was like a big jug of wine, the kids would always get into it, and we would always just drink ourselves unconscious. And anyway, I don't think I would have survived the rest. I don't think I would have made it out of childhood living in that. But when I was 11, my dad convinced me to come live with him in upstate New York. And so I don't know what it was about. They had a huge custody battle, but when I was like 2, they had a huge custody battle, which she won because it's the 70s. And moms always won back then. But when I was 11, she had a moment where she said, okay, go. And that was like the finest gift that my mom ever gave to me, was to let me leave. And I went and lived with my dad, and I like turned 12, and I never had to live in insanity or chaos or terror again. But I was already formed. A lot of that trauma was already there. And I already had a taste for booze. Really liked it. And so I found the other kids in this small town in upstate New York who liked to get high and liked to drink and liked to, you know, got into that phase of adolescent alcoholism where you steal alcohol from people's parents' bars and mix it all together in a jar and take it to school, that whole business. And I really enjoyed that. And the drinking age was 19 in New York at the time. And so it was pretty easy to find people who either were 19 or who looked 19 and had fake IDs to get us alcohol. So it's pretty easy to get alcohol at that time for us. And it just was a pursuit. I kept the school thing going. I kept the good grades going. I had a certain obsessiveness with getting my goals accomplished back then. And, that self-will was still at the moment serving me. And so I would party until I was unconscious or vomiting or whatever at every opportunity I had. I didn't have it on the weekdays that much opportunity. So I would do really well at school during the week and participate in extracurricular activities. And so even though there started to be a few little times where I would get caught, my dad just was like sort of baffled in this divorced single dad guy. And he just was like, well, she gets straight A's, so it can't really be a problem. And, you know, I ended up drinking myself into a alcohol poisoning incident at someone's bar mitzvah at the reception and woke up tied to a hospital bed and at like 4 in the morning without any idea of what had happened. And a couple of other kind of pretty poorly timed blackouts. My dad married my stepmother when I was almost 15, and I did it at their wedding reception too. And, you know, don't remember, but apparently I was letting everybody know I hated my dad for marrying that bitch, stuff like that at his wedding reception. So, but, you know, which didn't ingratiate me too much with my new stepmom, but I kept on getting the straight A's. And my dad would be like, but she does great. She does so well in school, and she's a gymnast, and she sings in the choir. So they had a lot of conflict about me because he had no idea that I was just an alcoholic, you know. And my stepmother, who actually had a dad who was an alcoholic and who hadn't drank for like 30 years but didn't do program or anything, she was like, she's an alcoholic, like her mother. And so they made me go to therapy. And, you know, I went to therapy and talked about how shitty my stepmother was. And like a little, maybe tiny little, every once in a while touched on how much my mom wasn't okay. I wasn't really too in touch with those feelings because it was too painful, really. At that time, I wasn't really ready to go over it. But, I appreciated the therapist for not telling on me for, you know, saying horrible things about my stepmother. And it planted the seed in the back of my head that maybe someday I might want to get some therapy. But mostly I just wanted to get the hell out of my dad and stepmother's house because they were cramping my style. And it did not occur to me at all in those years that there was any problem with what I was doing. Notwithstanding that I did get in various kinds of trouble throughout my teens, I just felt like the problem was the adults getting in my way and trying to stop me from doing what I wanted to do. So I ended up going to college a few states away, and that was a great break for me. And I drank myself, I almost drank myself out of college, but I didn't. I managed to pass everything learned how to pull it back a little bit and drink only on 4 nights a week instead of 7. And that was enabled me to readjust and go from terrible grades when I first got there to back up to the straight A's because I had plans and I was very driven and I kept on that double life going. And so, yeah, college was just like a lot of binge drinking, and that's what most of the people that I hung out with did. So it never occurred to me that that was problematic. And then something happened when I was 21, when we were 20, my best friend from childhood got sober. And I had been visiting her the whole time since when I moved to New York. I would still visit California to see my mom, and I would hang out with this best friend as we grew up on all those vacations and partied with her all those years, partied with her. We met on the playground in 6th grade with her asking everybody if they got high, and she got to me. Everybody was saying no. She got to me and I said yes. And so we got high together that day, and that's how we met. And so when we were 20, she got sober. And I thought that was a good idea because she had some drug problems, and I wasn't shocked that she needed to get sober. In fact, I'd been worried. And she lived in a different state from me. But I went to visit her for Christmas break of my senior year of college. And I hung out with her and a bunch of her buddies who are 20 and 21 year old through maybe 30 year old folks who were going to a ton of AA meetings. And they basically, most of them worked in restaurants. They hung out, you know, all night and smoked cigarettes and drank coffee and ate ice cream. And they were all dating each other. And they went to a lot of meetings. And I spent a week with them. And I went to one meeting just because I was staying there. And I always joke that meeting ruined my drinking. I mean, I drank for 7 more years, but it turned this light bulb on. And for the first time in my life, I was asking if maybe the way I drank might be problematic. Never, ever, ever had I ever asked myself that, not with blackouts, lots of them, not with vomiting on people, not with passing out inappropriate places, not with waking up with people I didn't want to be with, not with having my stepmother call me horrible names. None of it. But that one AA meeting and watching my friend be so happy and joyful and having so much fun and basically partying, but sober, clean and sober, and made me go, huh, I better be sure I don't have alcoholism. And so I started on this 7-year trip of like what kind of what they describe in the More About Alcoholism section of our book, where I was like trying to prove it to myself. I didn't tell anybody else, really. I just kept it to myself, but I was just starting to do tests. And for me, the tests were usually a length of time I was going to go without drinking. It wasn't so much trying to control the number of drinks. I never really did that. I did switch what I used, but mostly it would be like, I'll go this long. And the first time was that last semester of college when I went back from my Christmas break and I had the first thought like, huh, okay, I think I won't drink for this last 6 months of school. I won't drink. And then, you know, I I took off the week for spring break because, you know, I mean, who's not going to drink on spring break of senior year of college, right? So I gave myself that week off, and I made it 5.5 months, and I was like 2 weeks here or there, no big deal, just cut it off 2 weeks early. And I also didn't count hallucinogens. So basically, I proved it to myself that first round. I was successful at my experiment of one. And I didn't drink any alcohol for 5.5 months except for spring break. And so that was good for a while. And I never really drank again the way I had before. I was never able to drink without thinking about it after that. So I became a periodic drinker because the regular heavy binging that I had been doing up till then, I knew I couldn't do that because I didn't want to be an alcoholic. It was really important to me not to be an alcoholic because they can't drink. And now I had a friend who was sober, so I knew that they didn't drink. And I didn't know what they were doing at AA. I'd just been to that one meeting. But so the next 7 years, I controlled or enjoyed. And I didn't control numbers. I've never been able to control numbers. And I've actually never even tried. I never wanted to drink a little or to drink socially. I wanted to drink is to get loaded to me. So, but I too was a big pothead. So I kind of got into the marijuana maintenance program in terms of my alcoholism and would just drink sometimes. And drinking meant drinking myself. Not necessarily unconscious every time, but, you know, with some frequency unconscious, certainly blotto. And certainly making really poor choices. So I would limit when I drank to just certain times, certain weekends when it was okay, when the coast was clear. And I had a bunch of terrible relationships, almost got married, broke that up, cheated. I was always cheating with one, with the next one. That's how I would get out of a relationship. I'd cheat because I couldn't break up with people. I did actually go to graduate school. I finished graduate school on the marijuana maintenance program. And I started my career, and in graduate school, I got really, really depressed and anxious. And I now know that part of that was because I was working really hard to control my drinking. And I had never really known depression or anxiety before. I think I was I felt those things, but I didn't know it. The reason I think I felt them is because I had journals going back to age 13. And I was pretty regular journaler. And the writing was full of depression and anxiety. I was always either really worried about something or I was really depressed about something. And it's a constant effort to change myself. I always had all these things I needed to change about myself to be okay. That's all the journals were, was lists of things I needed to do or complaints about other people or complaints about myself, depression and anxiety, like all over it. But I never knew any of that. And I just was eager to get out of my head the next opportunity. So when I got to graduate school and I was mostly just getting high, I got pretty depressed. And at the end of the first year, I got suicidal. And somebody, my boss in my summer job, recommended a therapy place where people were, it was really inexpensive because they were getting their hours, their clinical hours. And so I was able to afford to go to this woman every week. And I went for 4 years to therapy. And, you know, it was during the finishing of my school. And she really, really helped. She really helped me do a lot of healing around some of the beginning layer of healing from that childhood trauma stuff. And at one point she asked me if I wanted to examine my relationship with alcohol and drugs. And I was like, no, that's my mom and my sister are the drug addicts. Like I was just, what? No. Oh, no, silly. So I was like, you don't talk to this woman about the drinking because she's going to make you look. So I just, you know, I just hid it from the therapist like we do. And it talks about in our book that we're, you know, we never really give a fair shake to medical people or psychiatrists because we don't tell them the truth, right? You know, and to the degree I was willing to be honest with her about whatever I was, she helped me a lot. And I do think she helped move me closer to being able to get sober. But I wasn't, you know, I was not going to come clean. I was not prepared to stop drinking and using yet. So, but I, you know, the damage in my life got to be way more on the moral fiber and way less on the furniture. You know, when I was younger, it was insane outer behavior and everybody knew it. And as I got into my 20s, It was occasional acting out, mostly sexually, lots of drunk driving. But externally, you wouldn't, unless you knew me well, you wouldn't necessarily know. But internally, I was more and more and more despondent and more filled with dread, just impending doom. The anxiety was just pressing in. And there wasn't really anything that bad going on in my life, really, when I look back, right? But I was more and more and more just frantic. And I was desperate to have a good life. And I couldn't make that good life happen. I had managed to get through school, and that had been the goal for so long. And I had this career, but like, I basically lost my ability to make things go. I like that like driving person that could just, you know, get good grades when I needed them and get the job, and she just kind of disappeared. And I was this like, really, really scared, really depressed. I had a job, but it was like a contract job. So basically I didn't have, I only got paid the hours I worked, and I didn't, and there weren't really any set hours I needed to be there. So basically if I worked 10 hours a week, they'd pay me for 10 hours and that was it. So a lot of times I was having a hard time showing up. I just didn't show up, and I was getting really, really broke, and my loans were coming due, and I had unopened mail starting to literally like pour out of drawers in my bedside table and my dresser. And I had dirty piles of laundry that were, I would move onto the bed when I had to get up in the morning and get dressed for work. And then when I get home at the end of the day, I would just move the piles back to the floor and get in the bed. And that's how I was living. I basically would watch Star Trek, which I still love, and just watch Star Trek reruns and drink red wine and get high at night, and then go to work to the degree I could manage it during the day. And every once in a while, really let myself drink. And that meant going out to a bar to pick somebody up and waking up with them. And that's kind of how it was. And then my roommate got sober. And so the last year and a half of my drinking was her first year and a half sober. And so that was my second best friend to get sober on me. And yeah, in that last year and a half, I got pretty close to killing myself from the depression and the anxiety. And, I went to some meetings with her, not for me, just because every once in a while she would take me to a Saturday night meeting because that's what she was doing. And I certainly didn't have any plans. Only years after I got sober did I even really remember that I did that, because I was not going to AA. But I did go to some AA meetings. But it wasn't until I had sort of this last horrible, horrible experience on a business trip for work where I humiliated myself and really could have ended up dead. Lucked out in terms of the physical safety part, but I just so humiliated myself over this trip that when I got back from the trip, I started to pray. And I had not really had a God growing up, but I had had these hippie parents that like God is love and a lot of like magical Santa Claus kind of God. Like if you really want something, you just think it hard and you can have it. That's how my mom was, right? Of course, you know, she's not a great poster child for getting what you want because she just like went slowly down. But they both were like spiritual people. And so nobody ever like talked me out of any kind of God. I had grandmothers who went to church, Catholic and Baptist, but nobody, you know, made me do much, but I didn't have anything against it either. And I was kind of a seeker by the time I was in my 20s with experimenting with meditation and, you know, self-help books, absolutely a lot of self-help in my 20s. I got sober at 28. And so in that, you know, that last year or whatever, I had been going to Zen Center and sitting real early in the morning in San Francisco, this newer apartment, doing various stuff. But the problem was I just kept drinking and smoking pot. So it didn't really help that much, the spiritual stuff. Then I had found this church through an article in the SF Weekly called One Weird Church. And it sounded weird enough, like a weird mix of music and art and cool people. And it was an Episcopal church, but a weird church. And I had decided I was going to go check that church out. So in August of 96, I started going to that church. And I had a spiritual experience there. I felt something. I felt tingles. I felt chills. And I cried. I cried every time I went for like the first half dozen times. I cried and cried. And so I started going every week. And then I ended up joining the church in October of 96. That last trip, that business trip was November of 1996. And when I got back to the States from that trip, I started praying in December of 96 and in January of 97. And on January 23rd, 1997, I got sober. So I do think that God brought me to AA, whatever God is. I have no opinion on what God is, but whatever that was, that spiritual seeking and finding something that felt comforting in the middle of my misery brought me to AA and brought the people into my life that got sober first, who were very important and are still both very important. My two closest friends, one's 32 years sober, one's 25 years sober. And so I started to pray when I got back from that business trip, and at the church, I would go and I would pray. And I was literally saying, if you exist, if you are an actual thing, if there is actually a God, if you show me what to do, I promise to do it. Because I had convinced myself with all that experimenting that I wasn't an alcoholic. I just thought I was insane. I knew when I picked up alcohol, all hell broke loose. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic, because how could I go 6 months without drinking or 3 months without drinking if I was an alcoholic? But after praying, 10 minutes, thank you, I started going to AA. And I started telling little bits of my story to a couple of the women that I met there. And I got a sponsor right away because I knew that my two best friends had gotten sponsors and worked the steps. So I worked the steps immediately. And I wasn't convinced I was an alcoholic until after I was through my first fifth step. But it hit me like a ton of bricks one day that, oh, I'm going to drink again. I actually don't have a choice not to drink. It's not about me controlling it. It's not about me deciding that I'm going to go to AA now and now I'm going to be sober. I will drink again. And when I had that realization after that first fifth step, it really was like a great first step. And I came to see that without help, it is too much for me. I will drink again. I will use drugs again. And I will go right back into the insanity and the desire to die that used to happen to me when I drank. So that was good to realize, to come to my innermost self, to know that I am powerless over alcohol. The life being unmanageable part was really obvious to me, but I needed that extra insight about the powerlessness because of all the experimenting that I thought I had succeeded at doing, only to find out, of course, it's what we do, is we experiment to try to prove that we're not alcoholics. So the second step, I already was kind of on this high of, I think God brought me here. So I was willing to take the leap and believe that something greater than me was going to help me. And so I did the third step with my first sponsor on the bathroom floor at the Dolores Park Cafe, holding hands and repeating after her the lines of the third step prayer. Did not know what I was doing, but I was willing to do whatever she said. And that's basically working a third step. And then she had me at once sit down and write the four columns in a spiral notebook exactly as they are in the big book and go through and do my fourth step. And I thought, you know, I don't probably need an inventory because I've been in therapy for 4 years and I've been just spilling my guts. But she was like, laugh. Yeah, do your inventory, you know. So I did my inventory and I it was very long. I really had a lot of, you know, basically mostly men and some women I was really pissed off about. Sex was really troublesome. And my parents, of course, they sucked. And, you know, everybody else that had done me wrong. I was such a victim. And when I read that first fifth step, it was the first time I had ever even thought about having a part in most of those resentments. And it was the first time I had ever read all those fears out loud. And I thought it was kind of life-changing. My sponsor, on the other hand, fell asleep. But it did. It really blew my mind. And I had not ever seen that I had a part in my relationship with my mother. I hadn't lived with her since I was 11 and I was 28 and I still blamed her for absolutely everything that happened to my, in my life. And that kind of came as a shock too. And so for 6 and 7, those first few times I worked the steps, I didn't really, there's not enough in there in the big book. I didn't get a lot of insight, but as I've stayed sober over the year, 6 and 7 have been really helpful because finding those repeating patterns of what I'm bringing to the party that makes me end up resentful, fearful, and, in a twist in relations with other people or work, the same things tend to show up. Self will run riot, desire to control, envy, fear, you know, mostly fear by 100 different names. And so 6 and 7 are, they're kind of like weird at first, but they end up being very practical as you go along. And then 8 and 9, man, writing down the list of people I had harmed and walking through that list with my sponsor and having her help me figure out how I was going to approach those people. I've had some great Ninth Step experiences. The most impressive to me was my stepmother. I hated the woman's guts. I mean, she had once told me when I was 15 that she would murder me, but it wasn't worth going to prison. She hated me so much. Like, you know, that's very victimizing. And, you know, by the time I got to my Ninth Step and made amends to her, mostly what I definitely had some apologizing, but I mostly wanted to thank her for how hard she had worked to take care of my dad and what a horrible child I was to him. And I sent this letter just thanking her, mostly thanking her. And she had like never even spoken to me for 10 years. And she, you know, she would answer the phone and be like, I'll get your father. She wouldn't even say hello. She sent me a birthday card that year saying, I love you. And it's been like that ever since. And my dad passed away 20 years ago and she and I are still friends. So that was just from the Ninth Step. It was amazing. And the 10th step is just continuing to take personal inventory. Again, over time, it becomes more of a natural rhythm of like more and more and more actually seeing the assets, things that are good that I do, and less like honing in on how shitty I am and how I keep doing the same things over and over. Mostly that's not true over the years. It took a long time though. And then the 11th step is, you know, my favorite is prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God as I understand him. And I don't understand him. I mostly think of God as good orderly direction. I get it mostly from other people in AA. I talk to people in AA every single day. I go to a meeting every single day now with Zoom more. And I've been going to a meeting 5-6 meetings a week for almost my whole sobriety. There's a middle period from 3 to 8 with having the kids that it was more like once a week, but for a long time now, it's been almost every day. And it's a revolutionary way to live. And then, of course, the 12th step is carrying the message and doing my best to practice these principles of all my affairs. I think I do better at carrying the message. I sponsor several people. I talk to my own sponsor regularly. And, you know, I wish I had spent more time talking about recovery, but I get all lost in my story like we do, but it's really been true for me that Alcoholics Anonymous is at the center of my life. And I know that's not for everybody, but it brings me so much joy and it brings me so much joy to see people recover. And I know people that I saw get sober that have 22, 23, 24 years of sobriety now. It's so, so cool. And if you're new, you know, I know it doesn't seem like it just seems so overwhelming at first and so scary, but it's just one day at a time. And we're here to help you. Like nobody's bullshitting when they say that it helps them to talk to you on the phone. Like when someone calls me who's struggling, I feel better. It makes me feel better to talk to an alcoholic who needs help. And so thank you. I see that. And I don't really have too much more to say, I guess, just, you don't need to let the God thing bug you or scare you off or whatever, because lots of people don't ever really end up having God as their higher power. My best friend, who's been sober 32 years, is very much an atheist. She prays. She just doesn't pray to God. It's just the act of praying that works for her. And it's been a big journey for her to try to figure out how to do her steps. But over time, she always found people to help her who were able to relate. And I'm like a crazy, everybody's God, you know, I'm like a pantheist, everything is God and the air is God and, you know, but everything in between, it doesn't need to be a deal breaker. The people here mean it. We really do want to help and they really have helped me. You have really helped me. So thanks for keeping me sober today.